What led up to World War II, and what lessons can we draw for today?
The distraction from true democracy and true leadership and true economic equality was great then. All the forces were providing a lot of propaganda, a lot of false hope. I see similarities in a lot of the economic and social dynamics today.
That's Jay Wirtz. We talk with him about his book, The World Turns to War. Then, in the wake of this week's events in Gaza, we re-air our 2016 interview with Susan Abulhawa about her novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water. It's about a Palestinian family. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us today on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. On May 7, 1945, Germany surrendered to the Allies in Europe. But it wasn't until September 2nd that World War II was officially declared over when Japan surrendered. It was the deadliest military conflict in history, with over 60 million people killed. As the world seems to be inching again to the brink of war, it might be instructive to ponder how we got into World War II in the first place. My guest Jay Wirtz has done just that with his book, The World Turns to War, published by Monroe Publications in December 2017. It weaves the stories of combat veterans into an event-by-event history of the war, illustrated by photographs, full-color images, and detailed maps. Many of those photographs have never been published before. The World Turns to War is the fourth volume in the series War Stories, World War II Firsthand. Two earlier volumes centered on the war in the Pacific, and a third was about D-Day, June 6, 1944. That one came out before The World Turns to War, although it was, of course, out of chronological sequence. That's because, as Jay Wirtz says,
that was to sort of get audience interest in the subject by using the D-Day, which is very prominent in a lot of people's minds in World War II history. But now we go back and tell the story of how the war really started, all the events that happened between the end of World War I and the beginning of the campaign in Poland on September 1st, 1939, that led the world back into yet another worldwide war, and a larger one than the previous one.
Yes, you actually start with World War I. Tell us why you started there.
Well, of course, there's a longstanding legend that the Treaty of Versailles and the other treaties that ended World War I were direct causes to the rising tensions in Europe and the rise to power of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party. That's not entirely true. A lot of that was true, but a lot of it was also propaganda on the part of Hitler and the Nazi Party to blame the West for the ills of Germany. In fact, it was a very complicated time. There were a number of forces going on in Europe. Immediately, there was a clash between the communist faction and those factions of ex-soldiers and others who did not believe in the communist worldwide takeover of the governments of Europe and elsewhere, and other economic pressures, both positive and negative, occurred that both tore down Germany's economy originally, but then built it back up, only to find it and the rest of the world torn down after the crash of the stock market and the Great Depression. So all of these mixture of economic, social, and political developments in the 1920s and the 30s led to the rise of dictatorial powers, particularly in Europe, and a continuation of a militaristic power in Japan that led the world back into war once again in 1939.
So how did World War I lead to communism and fascism? Because I think these are aspects we don't tend to think much about. Fascism just seems to appear full-blown. Communism, people don't even know that there was fighting in the streets between communists and fascists. So talk about how World War I destabilized Europe in such a way to create these mass movements.
Okay, so obviously communism began as a, in a practical sense when the Bolsheviks overthrew the czars in Russia, and that new government then pulled out of World War One. So they were not a party to that. However, in their mandate to push communism throughout the world, they immediately sent agents, and they had sympathizers in other countries, especially Germany, that saw the opportunity of the struggling new democracy in Germany as a target, the post-World War One situation there with a lot of chaos and changes. And they targeted many places in Germany on a local level and trying to create a situation where communism could take over in Germany in particular. Other countries too, but Germany was really the focus at that point. Bands of ex-soldiers were employed by the struggling democratic government, which later became known as the Weimar Republic in Germany, to go after the communists, and this ended up in a lot of street fighting between the two factions. Now, none of this really had to do with fascism and the rise of the Nazi Party as we know it, until just south of there, an ex-socialist, actually, Benito Mussolini, looked at some of the aspects of socialism, but not the Bolshevik, not the communist version, and said, I want to turn Italy around. I want to move it away from the monarchy it was and into a new kind of government. And the term fascetti, which is the forerunner of fascism, came about in Italy. These were, again, violent street thugs under the idea of forming a new government with Mussolini as the head. They marched on Rome in 1923, took over the government, and there developed the tenets of fascism, which had a lot of similarities to other socialist types of economic systems, but with a strong central and militaristic leadership under Mussolini that would then control both politically and economically the country. Then north of that, of course, in Germany, some parties were rising up, and a new one was created, not by Adolf Hitler, but he became their main spokesperson and really developed the strategy with other members into something very similar to the fascist type of government system and economic system that Mussolini had developed. So therefore, in the 1920s, late 1920s and early 30s, the fascism concept really took over the idea of the communism. The communists were their sworn enemies, and there continued to be a lot of street fighting between the two groups. But the rise of these two central dictatorial powers were really the driving force between the period after World War One and World War Two. Of course, a lot of other things took part. A lot of other forces were considerations, including the involvement of the United States economically, the other main powers of Western Europe, trying to keep German militarism down, but not succeeding very well. So there's a lot of chaos, a lot of different forces in play, because World War One was never really settled by the treaties. And there was never really the international organization that Wilson had hoped to develop that would keep the peace, particularly starting in Europe. And so all these chaotic forces under two very strong dictatorial leaders led to a new kind of militaristic power in Central Europe. And that, of course, led to the events that led up to the beginning of World War II.
So when you're talking about dictatorial leaders, you're talking about Stalin and Hitler or Stalin and Mussolini?
Well, interesting that you mentioned Stalin, because he was, in fact, as ruthless and as dictatorial in control of his government and his party in the Soviet Union as were Hitler and Mussolini, the two fascist leaders that I was mentioning. But if you add Stalin in, who was diametrically opposed to the concepts of the governments that were coming into power in Germany and Italy, you now have three very strong dictatorial forces, and they are overshadowing the few smaller democracies, the developing democracies in Central Europe, and of course the very war-weary democracies of Western Europe, those being Britain and France. So there was a lot of dynamics there on the part of the three rising dictators in Europe in the 1930s.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Jay Wirtz about his book, The World Turns to War. It's part of the series, War Stories, World War II Firsthand. You know, one thing that's very interesting from this history is to see how, you know, you said Mussolini was initially a socialist. The Nazis were called the National Socialist Party, you know, Workers' Party. How they used the language of populism to develop ideologies that were actually fully in the service of the big corporations and the military, something that, you know, we may be seeing today. So I wonder if you could talk about kind of this notion of outwardly populist, but actually oligarchic ideologies.
Well, you're very correct in that, Francesca. It's a disguised sort of politics. We like to think that populism as a concept, and perhaps we've had notions of that here in the United States in the past, that it becomes a more of a democratic system, a more of a shared economic system where all benefit, and a political system where everybody has a voice. That naturally was the selling point of those who came in with these new ideologies into their respective countries and their respective systems. But the leaders, the practical leaders of, not the theoretical leaders so much, but the practical leaders of these new social political dynamics, fascism, communism, those who were in practice knew that they had to have the strength of central power. They had to have a strong military, a strong system, policing system, because they could not afford to have very strong detractors, and they also had to have money. So those things coming together were quite dissimilar in a lot of ways to the monarchies and the aristocratic cultures that the populist nature of this new politics was supposedly rebelling against. But in fact, it was just a replacement of one power structure with another. The people had very little say, as it ultimately came about their future, about their economies, about the direction of their government, about whether or not their country would go to war. They were initially, in all cases, very briefly, I would think, in the Soviet Union, but certainly more true in Germany, they were all economically uplifted in the beginning of the rises to power. But that was a short-lived situation for the general population. They soon found themselves in pretty much the same situation as more control went to the central government and the arms of the central government, the policing arm, the military arm, the development of centralized industries, a lot of military industries. So people maybe had a short taste of what we might call true democracy, true equality that we like to think we have in the United States. But it was very short-lived at that time. I see similarities in a lot of the economic and social dynamics today.
Could you say a little bit more about that?
Well, it's interesting, but I believe that one of the things that is lacking in the culture of the new millennium and in the countries that consider themselves the world powers, all the major world powers, of course, are engaged in some sort of high-end economic development based on capital. We won't say they're capitalists. We won't accuse the Chinese government of being capitalists, but they realize the strength of a capital-based society in which a lot of economic development, but controlled economic development, can happen. I believe that the lack of leadership stimulation among a lot of people, the fact that so many things that we have today that are new, technologically new, lead people more into an aspect of following rather than leading and independent thinking, strikes very similarly to me with the populations and the stimulations that the populations of Europe had, both Eastern and Western Europe, in the 1930s. The distraction from true democracy and true leadership and true economic equality was great then. all the forces were providing a lot of propaganda, a lot of false hope, a lot of answers that only were temporary answers to uplifting the people in their situations. I see that today. I see a lack of true leadership being put out in a unified idea of let's make everything better and everybody better off, and let's make a better world. I see a lot of factional, selfish interests having their goal of developing a lot of followers, and that's very similar to what I saw happening in the 1930s.
Well, that's so interesting. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jay Wirtz about his newest volume in the series, War Stories, World War II Firsthand. It's called The World Turns to War. No, you know, as you say, this was not just, you know, the evil was not all on one side, although, of course, that side was exceedingly evil, but that there were problems on all sides. You talk about treaties being a central issue in the development of the Second World War out of the First World War. Why were the Western powers unwilling or unable to stop Hitler? And how did this issue of treaties play a role?
Hitler was, I should say, because one of the things that I delve into in the book, a lot of people don't know, is that a big thing, particularly for Britain and France, after the devastation and death of World War I, was to control, even eliminate, what they considered the Prussian culture of militarism, that strong military culture that had been so instrumental in earlier centuries, earlier times, in exerting its control over Europe. But it never really did go away. The treaties were somewhat specific in some areas, not so specific in others, but there were also workarounds. There were those in Germany who immediately started, even in the Weimar government, started to redevelop Germany's military. So by the time Hitler came along, that was already well along. That was one of the weaknesses of the treaties. The other weakness, and probably the most prominent weakness that we're familiar with, is the fact that the complexity of the treaties, combined with the war weariness of the Western powers, did end the ability for peace to be maintained in Europe. The new developing democracies, Yugoslavia, a reunified Poland, Czechoslovakia, they were obviously in between these two potentially dangerous giants, the USSR on one side, Germany on the other. So they needed guarantees from Britain and France, two war-weary nations, particularly Britain. And in turn, France, that was sort of the main player in the guarantees for those Eastern democracies, depended on the United States for backing, should a war break out, over the survival of those democracies. The United States government, not the president, because the president had a different mind. He wanted an international peacekeeping society, the League of Nations, to be able to resolve the differences. But the people, speaking through their Congress, did not agree with that. They were tired of being involved in European wars. They saw their sons. They saw a lot of the Treasury of the United States, the military of the United States, go to war on behalf of Britain and France, primarily against Germany in World War I, and they were tired of it. So they did not support, neither did they support Wilson's peacekeeping idea of the League of Nations, and they also didn't support the idea that the United States would guarantee France's security should France have to go to war against Germany again. So the treaties had very little teeth. And because of that, immediately those who were desirous of looking for loopholes did so. Then another thing that I do talk about in the book, which is a lesser known fact of this period, is the fact that Japan, which was building up a military culture and had shown its prowess against Russia in the early part of the century, and it had very little direct input into World War I, was using the distraction of the war, the distraction of the treaties, the distraction of peace in Europe to put their own agenda across what they call the Greater East Asia Prosperity Sphere. In other words, they were going after China. They were taking islands that were put under their control, and they were developing. So we had this other force of very militaristic force, very much of a force wanting to dominate a certain part of the world, developing at the same time. So we really had a situation developing in the 1920s and 30s that was, despite the fact that treaties were made, it was a much more dangerous situation than that that led the world into World War I.
So another thing that you talk about in the book is the rise of Hitler. It's just absolutely fascinating. You know, you start actually with him as a child. First of all, you know, I think we have an image of Hitler as just like this incoherent madman. But he had to have been pretty smart to get where he was. And I think that you talk about that. What were the main factors, do you think, in Hitler's rise? Given the fact that, you know, as you say in this book, he wasn't particularly all that popular, even as late as 1938. I mean, Kristallnacht and other things, you know, did not have the support of the German people. Give us that nuanced sense of Hitler's rise.
One has to wonder what the world would be like if the Vienna School of Art had accepted Adolf Hitler as a student in the early part of the 20th century. Real interesting that pivotal moment, because he really set out to be an artist. That pivotal moment in his life completely turned it around. And his inability to pursue his passion for art led him into pursuing a stream of consciousness of political thought, a lot of which was distorted, of course, by some of the other politicians and some of the other attitudes of the time. He became anti-Semitic. He became interested in the military. He served in World War I. He then, you know, had a disdain for communism and had a disdain for a lot of different people, but identified with a certain class of intellectualized military people that he identified with, and then led into his seeing politics and oratory as his rise. He was an unusual character, but once he developed his talent for oratory, his ability to grasp and evaluate people and create an organization. He took the steps necessary with, of course, all along the way, a healthy dose of violence carried out initially by his street thugs, the Brown Shirts, and later by other groups, and took all the way through September of 1939 a political route to gain power. And no, he did not always have the complete backing of Germany behind him, and certainly did not have the backing of the rest of Europe. But he had that unique ability to manipulate situations with good people, competent people, I guess I should say, people with various agendas of their own, various streaks of evil, but very competent people working with him to develop the tools necessary to gain that kind of leadership. But he did always want a war. He did always want to create a master race. He did always want to expand eastward on behalf of Germans and subjugate those countries in particular. So it was a really developing philosophy that he had, tainted, of course, by a lot of diabolical aspects of his personality and his mind. But there was no lack of ability to recognize how he could manipulate the populations, and indeed how he could manipulate Europe's leaders to get a start on what he wanted. That aspect of it we all know the results of, but to know how it started, I believe, is a very interesting story.
Yeah, it certainly is. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Jay Wirtz about his book, The World Turns to War. It's part of the series, War Stories, World War II Firsthand. Now, let me ask you a little bit about how you did this book. You talked to many, many eyewitnesses from many different countries, and you also have a huge number of photographs, some of which have never been seen before. So tell us a little bit about, you know, your sources.
Well, that's correct. And as you stated, this is the fourth volume in the series. For about a decade, I've been continuously seeking out and interviewing veterans and eyewitnesses of World War II and of the period. I had done a little bit of that work earlier in my career, but really concentrated about 10 years ago to get as many eyewitnesses and veterans as I could. So right now I have more than 600 from 22 different countries, and I'm still working on gathering them. That's an invaluable resource. I'm a writer. I'm not an academic historian. I'm a popular writer. And so I'm always looking for ways to get more people interested in the subject matter. I felt that by having a great pictorial work that would also illustrate the history that's being told in the story and the accounts of the people, and then having good maps to locate and understand the geographic dynamics of the situation was key to making this very popular and long-lasting. And by popular, I mean popular with a large group of people and long-lasting history of World War II. So that's what we set out to do. I have a very fine photo editor who searches every archive in the world if he doesn't have his own collection to get very unusual and telling pictures. Veterans and eyewitnesses have also offered their own. So we do have quite a mix of some very iconic photographs and images, along with some unusual and sometimes never before seen images.
Well, it's a terrific resource, The World Turns to War by my guest, Jay Wirtz. It's part of a series, War Stories, World War II Firsthand. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
Jay Wirtz is an author and film editor specializing in military history. In addition to the World War II series, War Stories, World War II Firsthand, Jay Wirtz is the author of The Civil War Experience and the co-author of Smithsonian's Great Battles and Battlefields of the Civil War. He wrote and directed the television series on which the latter book is based. Next, a novel of the Nakba. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. May 15, 1948 was the day Israel was established. It's also the day the Palestinians call the Nakba, or the Catastrophe, because it was the day the majority of the Palestinian people were expelled from their homeland. 70 years later, this week, it was also the day funerals were held for the more than 60 unarmed Palestinians shot and killed by Israeli snipers during protests in Gaza. Some 2,700 people were wounded by those same snipers. Some were children, like 8-month-old Laila Al-Khandour, who died after being exposed to tear gas dropped on the crowds by Israeli troops. A few months ago, Writer's Voice aired an interview with Norman Finkelstein, the child of Holocaust survivors, whose most recent book is Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. You can go to writersvoice.net to hear that interview. But instead, today, we re-air our 2016 interview with novelist Susan Abulhawa. That's because we in the West so seldom hear stories from the Palestinian point of view. Well, Susan Abulhawa's fiction corrects that. Her first novel was Morning in Jenin. Her second is The Blue Between Sky and Water. It's the story of one Palestinian family told from the day of the Nakba in 1948 to today. What happens when a people are expelled from their homeland, from their homes where their families tilled the land for centuries, where their ancestors are buried, where they had hoped to build bright futures for their children? How do they retain their humanity in the face of such injustice? And how do they knit their lives and their families back together in spite of it? All these questions come vividly alive in Susan Abulhawa's new novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water. It's a powerful story about one Palestinian family that follows them from their idyllic village life in pre-Israel Palestine, expulsion in 1948, and through exile in Gaza and the U.S. Through it all runs the indomitable spirit of women, from the matriarch in Gaza, who holds the family together in the face of brutal occupation, to a young niece who returns to Palestine looking for her real home after a childhood spent in foster care in the U.S. Author Susan Abulhawa's first novel was the best-selling Mornings in Jenin. Now, in The Blue Between Sky and Water, she immerses the reader in the rich lives of the characters in a way that forever shreds the ugly stereotypes of Palestinians and Muslim women so current in the West. In addition to her writing, Susan Abulhawa also works with Playgrounds for Palestine, an organization she founded. Her parents were refugees of the 1967 war. Susan Abulhawa, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This is just one of the most powerful novels that I've read. The Blue Between Sky and Water. This one was so powerful, not only the way it was written, but because of its subject. It's a story about the Nakba, the expulsion of Palestinians from their homeland in what became the State of Israel, and their lives under Israeli occupation. The story also takes place in the Gaza part of those occupied territories. But it's also the story of a family, and one particular family. Let's start with the family itself, just to introduce the characters. I think a lot of people think that Muslim women have no power, but the women in this story are its heart and soul. So tell us about them.
There are several women of different generations in the same family who dominate this narrative. The principal ones are Nazmiye. She's a matriarch in the family. She's kind of a wisecracker, manipulative, foul-mouthed, maternal, loving, sort of uninhibited in a lot of ways, and her word is the last word in the family in every way. And the other main character is Nur. She is Nazmiye's grandniece, and Nur grows up in the U.S. She's the woman in the family who kind of gets lost. Her grandfather travels to the United States, and he passes away before they're able to return to Gaza, and she ends up growing up in foster care. So Nur, even though she, and this is explicitly stated in the story sometimes, she kind of grows up with everything that they want in Gaza, with opportunity, freedom to move about, to go anywhere in the world, with this magical American passport, clean water, plenty of food, education, opportunity, etc. But somehow Nur is kind of the most broken one among them in a lot of ways, having grown up without family and sort of institutional care. It was an experience that kind of burrowed holes in her. Another character is Alwan. Alwan is Nazmiye's daughter, who you can imagine kind of growing up with such a forceful mother and with such a big presence. Alwan is a little bit more in the shadows. She's more reserved, but her waters run really deep, and she's a complicated character. She's pious and religious, but also a thinker too, and she questions a lot of the assumptions that were kind of handed down to her by society. And her daughter, Rachel, is the youngest of these women, and she's sort of the face of hope, or of the future, rather, and the person that they're all kind of investing themselves into, in a way. And there is one primary male character, Rachel's brother, Khaled, and he's kind of the thread that binds everyone and binds previous generations and future generations. And his voice is kind of, it's an ethereal kind of otherworldly voice, because although he is flesh and blood, at least for a part of the narrative, Khalid goes into a kind of coma-like state called locked-in syndrome, and where he can perceive the world around him, but he cannot respond or interact with the world. So in other words, he can see, hear, feel, smell, but he can't respond except by blinking his eyes or moving his diaphragm to breathe. And so in that sort of prison of his own body, Khalid finds his own freedom. He retreats into himself, and he's able to then transcend time, to transcend the physical world that those around him are bound by. So those are the characters, and it's interesting that you sort of brought up this stereotype of Muslim women. I did a couple of book tours recently for translations of the novel, and one of the comments that I got rather consistently, and so more than twice, was how surprised people were that the women, not only did they, you know, sort of defy images or stereotypes of the passive, sort of subservient, quiet Muslim woman, but there was a surprise that the women could be so different from one another. And to me, that was more telling than anything about how the world sees us as Muslim women, as being sort of almost uniform, necessarily similar. I don't think it would occur to anyone that, oh, wow, if the characters had all been white and Western, that, wow, they're so different from each other. How can that be? And the fact that it was such an immediate response or impression by some Western readers from this novel really kind of speaks to what the general perception is of Muslim Arab women and how we are supposed to be in the world.
What do you attribute that to?
Well, the West really isn't exposed to a lot of to Muslim women very much. It's not like there are any television shows that show Muslim women, ordinary Muslim women, in any kind of life situations, except as victims of, you know, crazy, of a crazy world, and or as passive. You know, the image that people have is the image that's perpetuated in popular culture, whether it be film, news media, or newspapers, broadcast media. If you think about what people in this country see, I mean, that's the stereotype. It's really not just for women, but also for men. I mean, when was the last time you saw a film with a loving Arab Muslim father in it? Or you know, a comedian, an Arab comedian? Or, you know, people aren't interested in our lives in that way, except as we are relevant politically, or how we fit into sort of American foreign policy or something.
Yeah, especially at this time when the images of Muslims are, you know, such images that inspire hatred and are meant to inspire hatred. Those are the images that are being put out there. But let's go back to this wonderful book, because one of the things that I think it did is that it really does open this culture and the richness of Palestinian culture to the reader, and does so within the context of exile, really. You know, exile either into under occupation or even further on, as what happens with Noor. So let's go back to the beginning. It starts in 1948 in the village of Beit Daras. Is this a real village, by the way?
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about that and, you know, what the life of the people are like there just in the moments before the Israeli army comes in and expels them quite brutally.
Well, Beit Daras, like most Palestinian villages were, especially rural ones, were mostly agricultural. communities. Beteras had a beekeeping industry. So yeah, the main industries in Beteras were agriculture and beekeeping. And the bit in there about the schools and when they were built and so forth, the classrooms and the collections to pay the teachers, that's actually real. I got that information from a dear friend of mine who wrote a book about Beteras. He's from Beteras. His name is Ramzi Barud. And the book is called My Father Was a Freedom Fighter. So I was able to get a lot of information about Beteras. There's quite a history around it. And it was like all other towns. I mean, people were, they were busy with their lives. You know, it was a community, like many other communities in Palestine, that had lived under various rules under the Ottomans and then the British and many others before them for thousands of years. But it was really only the new Israeli conquest by principally European Jews that had settled in Palestine. That was the first conquest and occupation that really sought to eliminate Palestinians and remove them from their ancestral lands and replace them. You can imagine it was, the whole village was traumatized. And then this particular village was mostly pushed into Gaza, and a lot of the residents of Beteras ended up in refugee camps there.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Susan Abulhawa about her terrific new novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water. So now they go to Gaza, and on the way, I mean, during this whole terrible expulsion, there is an incredible incident with a, I don't even know how to pronounce it. Jinn? Is that?
That's right. It's Jinn.
Jinn. Okay. So
yeah, that's where the word genie comes from.
Right. And there are some pretty strong elements of magical realism in the story. I mean, you've already referred to Khaled, who does make an appearance in the beginning of the story in 1948, even though he's really not born until decades later. So first, tell us what a jinn is and what he does, what is this kind of appearance in the book and in the culture, and then why did you use these elements of magical realism in The Blue Between Sky and Water?
A jinn is, that's where the word genie comes from. They are otherworldly creatures, magical creatures, that most Muslims, especially Muslims in rural areas, believe in, because they are mentioned in the Quran. And the Quran sort of validates their presence in the world. So when I was growing up, my grandmother really believed in jinn, and so it was part of my childhood, at least. And, you know, like when I was naughty or something, or if she was mad at me, she would, you know, say something like jinn irkabek, or which means may a jinn possess you. and I was kind of terrified, you know, being possessed by a jinn. And then I, you know, as I sort of got a little bit older, I was thinking, oh, how cool it would be to have a jinn friend, and they could just make all my wishes come true, and it would be a good jinn. I mean, so these were, you know, it was just part of my childhood, and I had really strong memories of those thoughts and ruminations that went through my young, innocent mind. So it was, it felt natural and organic to have a character who was able to communicate with the jinn, and it's actually Nazmiya's mother. She was considered the village, you know, crazy woman. And so, the jinn's name is Suleiman, and he mostly is in the beginning of the story, although he makes a couple of minor appearances here and there in other parts. But, you know, this element of the book is in many ways tangential. So it's, but it was an element that felt, it felt right. I don't really ever plan a novel. I don't plan the stories. I don't really know what's going to happen. I start with an idea or a seed, and then I kind of write for a long time, almost stream of consciousness. And then when I have a big when I have volume, in other words, when I have lots of pages, I just kind of go back and start molding and rewriting and thinking about characters and getting to know them and just, you know, kind of letting their stories unfold organically. And that, you know, the djinn being in there was made perfect sense to me.
And he may be tangential, but Khalid is not. And
no.
He also, I mean, he goes back in time to teach Nazmiya's mother how to read. Nazmiya's sister how to read. That's right. Maryam, yes.
Mm-hmm.
She with the one brown eye and the one blue eye, as Noor also has. So, I mean, these are elements that I guess as a reader I had to see as symbolic of the larger story. Is they just came out of your stream of consciousness, or is there something that you're saying of a more, you know, metaphorical meaning of this idea that time, the idea of time in the novel?
So the idea of time not being linear or at least being perverted in some way was also present in my previous novel, although perhaps, you know, not so obviously. And for Palestinians, time in a lot of ways has become almost circular or at least frozen in some ways. The generation that was exiled in 1948 never really left 1948. You know, they lived in these refugee camps, dreaming and imagining going home and holding on to their deeds and their keys and their life goal and their purpose. Their whole purpose in life was to return to their homes. And they kind of passed that longing onto the subsequent generations. And so there's a whole portion of Palestinian society that, in a lot of ways, hasn't been able to leave 1948. And there are actually concrete and political reasons for that, not just spiritual or emotional, psychological reasons. And likewise, you know, the same thing happened to those who were exiled in 1967. So there is kind of this, you know, when history is not redeemed for people, and, you know, you kind of end up living in this collective wound, whether you want to or not, because it becomes part of your identity in a way. So that's, I suppose that's something, you know, readers can consider when it comes to the elements of time in this novel. Mm-hmm. First, you know, Khalid being magical realism or not, his, you know, his condition, what he does. I mean, I did leave it open for readers to consider that there were perhaps more conventional explanations for what was happening to him. You know, at one point, someone describes his condition, or his grandmother's condition, rather, sorry, great-grandmother's condition as being schizophrenia, and, you know, being locked in one's body and one's mind can create all kinds of thoughts and that aren't real and so forth. So there, you know, for the logically minded among us, you know, it's open to that kind of interpretation. But it's also open to other interpretations that, you know, that actually this was real, that he did travel in time and all this really did happen exactly as it says it happened. So, you know, what's real probably is not the point.
Right. I want to go back to what you said about time in this, though. There's a really telling moment in the book where you write about the bombing of Gaza, and you write that Israel's bombing of Gaza altered the clock. It's a powerful passage to read. Israel has bombed Gaza quite a number of times, but I'm thinking this might have been, what, 2009? No, I'm not sure when was that one. But just that
2008, 2009. It was December 2008 into January 2009.
Right, exactly. So you write that Israel's bombing of Gaza altered the clock. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, people, you know, living amidst this incredible destruction should have put you in this immense kind of pause. Life has paused. The earth isn't spinning anymore. The sun is kind of stuck in the sky, and it's just beating down on you, and, you know, there's nowhere to go, you know. What do you do? except try and salvage. And I think these kinds of situations are so profound and so heavy and so dense and so laden with things that are incomprehensible to those of us who don't live these moments, that it's powerful enough to make day into night and night into day and just stop the earth spin as far as you're concerned.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and we're talking with Susan Abel-Hawa about her novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water. So just so our listeners know a little bit, I found the passage. I'm going to read a little bit from it, if it's okay with you. Just the first paragraph of that chapter. Israel's bombing of Gaza altered the clock. As if time had been wounded, it now moved in a crawl. Its daily passage impeded by the rubble that carpeted the terrain, its presence so thick that Hajja Nazmiya felt the sun dragging along the heavy weight of each hour. So much needed to be done, yet there was nothing to do. People gathered with nothing to say. Even when they spoke, their words were coated in a silence that stared into a chasm as they picked out and buried their dead. Even rage and calls for revenge seemed perfunctory. Tears made for a sort of refuge, a place to go to feel something in a wreckage that demanded numbness. For many, it was simply a waiting to die. Hope seemed vulgar in this hour, and the idea of death was so comforting and alluring that no one spoke, lest words do away with the seduction of a quiet ending. And I wanted to read that because, first of all, the language is beautiful, but I think it's in evoking the real experience of people that you can really move hearts. I have never really been inside, you know, what happened in this way that you express. And tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, your own experience. I assume you've been to Palestine. Is that right? Okay, so tell us a little bit about your own experience of this kind of situation and how that...
I've never lived through bombing.
But you
lived in Palestine when I was younger. I lived in an orphanage in Jerusalem. And I've been back many times each year, and until last summer when I was not allowed in. But I've not lived through bombing campaigns. I've witnessed the aftermath, but I was never a victim of that.
You lived in an orphanage in Jerusalem?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to say something about how you got there?
Not really.
The reason I ask is because Noor, I had a sense that there was a backstory to Noor that reflected some of your own.
The part about Noor living in foster care in the U.S. Is real. I did live in foster care in the United States, but prior to that, I lived in an orphanage in Jerusalem. And that experience actually was I put the lead character in my first novel, Mornings in Jenin, in my life in that orphanage for 3 years. So I did kind of talk about it in the novel, but I'm really not all that interested in talking about how I got there. It doesn't really matter.
Okay. But then the foster care, this is another very strong element in this story, which is the story of Noor, who is not only exiled from her family in Gaza, in Palestine, but she is also exiled from her own family. Her grandfather, who she loves, dies when she's quite young. Her mother is a flaming narcissist who, you know, is terribly rejecting. So tell us a little bit about this theme. I mean, it seemed to me it was very relevant to the larger political theme, but it's also a very striking human story in itself.
Well, I mean, Noor does, like I said, she ends up in the United States alone, and she's forced to go into to foster care, and she becomes a ward of the state. And, you know, she grows up in kind of a very empty adequacy, I guess. You know, foster care was adequate. That's how it was for me. You know, got enough food, enough, you know, good shelter, etc. I never experienced any of the horror stories that one hears about in foster care. But it was, you know, it was nothing anyone would ever describe as home. It was in existence, and it was adequate. And that's what Noor experienced, and that was sort of the basis of her longing to go to Gaza.
Well, is there anything else you would like to say about the book? You know, what was the greatest challenge for you in writing this, and what would you most like a reader to take away from it?
You know, I don't have expectations of readers. In fact, I'm more interested in hearing what they do take away of their own accord. And also, I have to say too that when I'm writing, I don't ever think about the reader or how they're going to react or what they're going to take from anything. I don't think about the publisher either. I don't even think about the politics or you know what my community is going to think of me or et cetera for having you know these certain elements in there that might be frowned upon, et cetera. My only loyalty really is to the characters. I work really hard to get to know them and to love them, to feel something towards them, even if it's a negative feeling. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I hate to break in, but you say you don't care about the politics, but the politics is a very crucial part of this story, and there is a lot that you write in this story that is
very important to me to get the politics right.
Not
the politics so much, but the history and the reality.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think that's what I mean. And the way you present the Israeli occupation is, you know, the way I think my ancestors in Europe would talk about the Nazi incursions into their communities. I mean, it's very strong language and it's powerful language, and it made me really think a lot of things through. You know, I mean,
well, and that's what the characters are thinking. And again, that kind of goes to my loyalty to the characters and to their lives and to their realities and how they see the world and you know what they're surrounded by. So, I mean, you know, that's maybe it sounds like you're having a hard time sort of accepting that, but that's the reality.
I'm not. But I'm thinking that in this time, when mm-hmm. when the politics is so raw, where Islamophobia is, you know, just exploded all around us, where, you know, the struggle of the Palestinians, I mean, I think, you know, in the U.S., certainly, maybe in the rest of the world, people are beginning to understand more the injustice of the Israeli occupation, but here at home, they don't. So that's why I guess I feel like a book like this, you know, the politics, yes, it's not just the reality of the characters, but it's also telling the reader what it's like.
You know, you say that because you're a Western reader, but maybe, you know, Palestinian readers read this too, and they're very much aware of the situation. So again, readers, there's all kinds of readers, and they read things for different reasons, and they react differently, and they see things differently, and that's my point.
Fair enough. Susan Abulhawa, your wonderful novel, The Blue Between Sky and Water, I recommend it to all our listeners. It's a wonderful read, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Francesca.
In addition to The Blue Between Sky and Water, Susan Abulhawa is the author of Mornings in Jenin and the founder of the organization Playgrounds for Palestine. Our interview with Susan Abulhawa originally aired on Writer's Voice in January 2016. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.